Well, as folks are coming back in, we're going to get started. I'm going to read a couple of passages, and if you have your notes out, we're kind of playing Name That Tune. So I'm going to not give you the reference, and I want you to see if you can identify both the speaker and the century, the time period that these things were said. So you may have no idea, and that's okay. But I'm just going to read these, and you see if you can figure out where they came from. The Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and will call him Emmanuel. And here's another one. This one's longer, but this is the last one I'm going to read. And then you figure out who said it and when. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as men rejoice when dividing the plunder. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of the oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle, every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. For to us, a child is born. To us, a son is given. And the government will be on his shoulders. And he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. Name that tune. Don't speak it out, but in your notes, if you have any idea who said that, write it in the blank. And just take a wild guess if you don't. It came from the Bible. I'll give you that hint. And I'll also give you another hint. It's a prophet. It's a prophet that spoke those things. So just do your best, figure out who, see if you can guess who it was that said that and when they said it, how long ago that was said. Some of you probably, like, right off, you know. Others have no idea, and that's okay. That's okay. We're not going to have anybody come up to the front and embarrass anybody. Who wants to take a stab at it? Who was it that said those things? Some of you know, I'm guessing. Anybody willing to? Begins with an I. Yeah, a couple of nods. We don't want to say anything. Begins with an I and ends with a Isaiah, right? Anybody know? Isaiah. Yes. Now, when did Isaiah speak? When did he speak these things? Anybody want to guess the century? Gary says 500 BC. Can I get a 600 BC? 600 BC. Can I get a 7? I think I got a 7 down here. This was spoken in the 8th century BC. 8th century. So we're talking like 700 something BC. 700 years before Jesus was born, Isaiah said, a virgin will conceive, and they're going to call him Emmanuel. One of the kids' classes in the 9 o'clock hour have been talking about prophecies and things that were said about Jesus before he came, and there are so many prophecies in the Old Testament. Micah was another one who prophesied during Isaiah's time. He's the one who said, this Messiah will be born in Bethlehem. They gave the location. Daniel gave the date when he's going to come. He said, after so many years after this person issues this decree, the Messiah will come. The specific details of the Messiah's coming is phenomenal. It's astounding how much detail we were given. So I want to call Isaiah the prophet of Christmas this morning. He's kind of my favorite Christmas prophet because out of all the Old Testament prophets, he prophesied more about Jesus than any other prophet. And he talked about his birth, He talked about his death. He talked about his resurrection. He spoke about a lot of it 700 years before he was born. So these kinds of prophecies and others like them, they give strength to our faith. Because we have copies of these from before Jesus was born. It's not like, well, they just wrote it after the fact. You can't say that and be intelligent. Not if you're looking at the witness, the records. So I love these things because they strengthen our faith. This is intelligent faith. And I love to think about the fact that God told us so much about this before it happened, because only God can do that. Only God can do that. So I want to go back to this time when Isaiah spoke that and just get a better understanding of why those words might have been so meaningful to them. Why would these words, "The people walking in darkness have seen a great light"? Those words they needed to hear. So we're going to have a little bit of a history lesson at the beginning here. I don't know if you like that or not, but, I don't always give history lessons, so you'll have to bear with us. The first verse of Isaiah sets the stage. This is when Isaiah is speaking. It said, Isaiah prophesied during the reigns of four kings in Judah: Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. So, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, how much do you know about those four kings? Probably not a whole lot. I don't. But I want to give you the setting of what's going on here, so you can see it, and I'll tell you why in a little bit, so maybe you don't have any idea why we're talking about this, but here's just a very, very quick survey of Israel's history. Okay, we talked about Joshua a while ago. That's when they went into the promised land. This was a high point for Israel. They were doing great, and ups and downs, but overall doing great. Then they went into time of the judges, multiple different judges, and they sunk down, they drifted away from God, and they ups and downs, roller coaster ride in judges. Then the time of the kings came, so we're talking hundreds of years here. Time of the kings came, we want a king. So they got Saul, David, Solomon. In general, that was a pretty good time for Israel. Fairly good, fairly high point with David, Solomon especially. But then after Solomon died, the kingdom split. And you've got the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. 10 tribes up here, 2 tribes down here. This is like Jerusalem and Judah, that area, 2 tribes. The other 10 are in the north. And so we are, when Isaiah is, it's in the middle of that time. It's been about 160 years, 165 years since Solomon. And then we've got these four kings. And then there's going to be another 160 years or so before the exile begins. So we're kind of right in the middle of that time. And overall, this period of time is a time of decline. They're falling further and further away from God. So we're kind of in the middle of that with these four kings. And that's the scene. They're kind of drifting further and further away until they finally get to the point where God says, enough. I'm sending the Babylonians to take you away from the promised land. You've lost it. And they lost it for a while. They did come back. But during this time when these four kings are and Isaiah is when the northern kingdoms were basically defeated. The Assyrian nation came in and they basically obliterated the 10 tribes. They scattered them around the entire Assyrian kingdom. And that happened during Isaiah's time. So Isaiah's going to be giving warnings. He's going to be saying, watch out. You guys are drifting away from God. Lots and lots of warnings, lots and lots of judgment is in the book of Isaiah, and it's during this time because they're going further and further away from God. So overall, these are ever darkening days for God's people. You can learn some more about those kings in the book of 2 Kings, but these four guys, when Isaiah was over a period of 60 years, the four kings we're talking about were not all bad. These four guys, they were not all bad. Uzziah and Jotham were actually fairly decent. They were fairly decent kings. They followed God. They worshipped him. And what you see, that their only fault was they neglected to remove the high places. And you're going to find that in the kings. God would that was a big deal to God, whether they removed the high places or did not remove the high places. So what that means is the high places were places of worship. where they would worship false gods. And so these two guys, they were fairly on, but they did not remove the high places and really take a stand of leadership and stop the people from worshiping the false gods. So they did not do that. Everything else was fairly okay. Now you get to Ahaz, different story. Ahaz was bad, all the way through bad. One of the worst. Pretty much abandoned God completely. So Isaiah's working in this time when they have this terrible, terrible king. One of the things that we know in 2 Kings 16, he went so far, he sacrificed his own son. Like, killed his son in an offering of worship to some false god. Killed his son. That's crazy. Does it get any worse than that? For the king to kill his own son as an offering of worship. Imagine what would happen if something like that happened today. The mayor of Kutztown decides, you know what? I'm worshiping this new god, and they want us to kill our firstborn children. So we're going to do that. What would happen to our mayor? She would be in jail the rest of her life. Right? Ahaz killed his son and stayed king. Apparently this was okay. Crazy. That should be shocking. These were not good times. Next king comes along. He's Hezekiah. Somehow, he's a good king. He's a godly king. And it says he removed the high places. Ahaz was his father. Hezekiah wasn't killed. Some other son was killed. Hezekiah survived somehow. He decided this is not okay. He removed the high places. He destroyed false worship. And he led the people to worship the one true God. He was a good king. One of his claims to fame was, I don't know if you remember in history, Moses at one point was commanded to build this bronze serpent. Like, God's people were up and down, back and forth, and they were rebelling against God. They were all dying of this plague because God said, you know what? You do this, you die. So they're all dying, and he said, if they want to be saved, build this snake. They look at the snake, and they will be healed. And it worked. They looked at the snake, they were healed. That snake was not an idol. It was not an object of worship, but they kept it. And now it was an object of worship. So one of Hezekiah's things was he destroyed that snake. Fine. Like, this is a great reminder of our history and what God did. I'm destroying it because you're worshiping it. One of his claims to fame. Next king after Hezekiah was Manasseh. If you know anything about Manasseh, it's worse than Ahaz. Let me see if I can find where I am here. Manasseh was one of the worst. And I can't even find my spot. Here it is. He was credited with doing more evil than the nations the Lord had destroyed before the Israelites. The nations that were so evil they needed to be destroyed, Manasseh was worse than them. And he came right after Hezekiah. Jewish history says that Isaiah was most likely killed by Manasseh, put in a log, and sawed in half. So Manasseh comes on the scene. I am tired of you and what you're saying. I'm going to get rid of you. One of the first things he did, most likely. That's not in the Bible. That's in Jewish history. So I can't say for sure, but Isaiah ended right there. So this is the atmosphere they lived in. There were some ups and downs. There were some good times and bad times. But overall, they are going down, down, down. Decline. Further and further away from God. So you see that whole progression from Joshua's high point, judges up and down, kings, okay, divided kingdom, just tanking out until the exile. I wanted to paint that backdrop so you get a better picture of what's going on when Isaiah is speaking, when he brings these prophecies. The ones I read to you are good. They're hopeful. He gave some messages of hope. But a lot, it was surrounded by these messages of judgment and warning. So for six decades, Isaiah speaks these warnings and judgments. Turn back to God. Turn away from this wickedness because judgment is coming. It's coming. Captivity is coming. He warned them about it. Ruin is coming. Babylon is coming. But in all of that, there's scattered throughout that, there's hope. It's not going to be bad forever. God is going to restore you and the Messiah will save you. There's hope throughout this book. And that's where you find these beautiful prophetic words that I read earlier. To us, a child is born. to us a son is given, and he's going to bring unending peace. So that they're in the time of darkness. People walking in darkness have seen a great light. They needed a light badly. And that light's going to come through a baby, a child who would become a king, a righteous king who would reign on David's throne forever. The message of hope is woven throughout Isaiah's prophecies of judgment. If you're in your notes, we're at number 3, a contemporary parallel. The reason I wanted to take the time to get into that is because it seems to me that we're living in a similar situation. We live in a country that was founded on Christian principles and led by men of faith. Not everyone says that now. History is being rewritten. But I have some quotes from our founding fathers. We have their diaries. We have journals. We have written documents. So I can give you things that they said that show where were we in the beginning and where are we now. Faith in Jesus Christ was very much a normal thing in early America. Is it a normal thing now? This not everybody in the early colonial days, not everybody was a follower of Christ. There was freedom. But prayer was normal. It was expected. It was everywhere. It was in school. It was in government. It was all over the place. Schools taught children to read using the Bible. The providence of God was part of the bedrock of our country. Most people attended church. And the schools were, their educational material came right out of this book. Not because it's the only book they had, because there were people of faith that believed this is where wisdom is found. They had incredible respect for God's word. And the system of democracy itself was built on the foundation that we are religious, moral people, which isn't really true anymore. So I got a couple of quotes related to that, because it's pretty important that they understood we're accountable to God. So I'll start with the big one, George Washington. Just a short quote from George Washington. You can find a lot more. Here's one thing he said: religion and morality are the essential pillars of civil society. Religion and morality, essential pillars. First president. Second president, John Adams. We have no government. He said this to a group of military folks, this big group, military people. He said this: we have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It's wholly inadequate to the government of any other. You might have to think about some of these things there to understand what are these people saying. Here's another one. This is one of my favorite founding fathers. Noah Webster wrote the first American dictionary. He was one of our founding fathers, and it gets even stronger here. The moral principles and precepts contained in the scriptures, so when they say religion and morality, they're talking about this, not just anything, in the scriptures ought to form the basis of all our civil constitutions and laws. All the miseries and evils which men suffer from vice, crime, ambition, injustice, oppression, slavery, and war proceed from their despising or neglecting the precepts contained in the Bible. Noah Webster, that's what he believed. This one is a little more modern. This is something Ronald Reagan said at a prayer breakfast in 1984. Without God, there is no virtue, because there's no prompting of the conscience. Without God, we're mired in the material, that flat world that tells us only what the senses perceive. Without God, there's a coarsening of the society. And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure. If we ever forget that we're one nation under God, then we will be a nation gone under. Those are chilling words. They sound prophetic. 240 years has taken a significant toll on the spiritual condition of our country. we have drifted into darkness. Put ourselves on this timeline. When things started out well, we have been going down. Not every person, but our society, our culture, what's right and what's wrong. We have been drifting into darkness. Think about how quickly things are changing right now. 10 years ago, things that were absolutely out of the question are law today. Things that were illegal, immoral acts a few years ago have now become normalized to the point where if you even suggest otherwise, you will be punished. Churches are being sued for holding convictions they found in the Bible people have been living with for centuries. Pastors' sermons are being subpoenaed. Don't be fooled. People don't have the freedom to believe what they want to believe anymore. Things are changing fast. We're being pressed harder and harder, not only to approve of things that God doesn't approve of, but to embrace them. Things that God has warned us will destroy us. That's where our culture is. It's as if our whole culture is in this red Ferrari driving this way with the pedal to the floor as far away from God as possible. God's over here, and they are just cruising as fast as they can. And they have these grappling hooks saying, you better come too. That's where we are. Rocketing deeper and deeper into the darkness. So as I look at where we're at, I feel like we're in troubling times, just like Isaiah was in troubling times. The idol worship of Isaiah's day is the absolute rejection of God's wisdom in our day. It's not that much different, really. Just as the nation of Israel was crumbling, so is ours. Just as their nation was headed for disaster, so is ours. Merry Christmas. This is the climate that we're in. A day of darkness, and the light has come. This is the message that we need. The light has come in the darkness. So I've been thinking about this stuff this week, and I mean, not just this week, but our condition, culturally and spiritually, is disturbing. It's disturbing. And, you know, you and I have talked, some of us have talked about this already, but I want to just poke a few holes in the darkness. That it's not all darkness. It's not too late. We're not gone under yet. There are bright spots worth celebrating still. And when I look at the big picture, it's more darkness. When I look at little things, specific things, I find hope. So I want to share a little bit of that with you after we've painted this bleak picture. In Kutztown, I have realized that public officials still see churches as places where people can find hope. Public officials still feel that way. Cornerstone has a positive relationship with the borough of Kutztown. And as we're working with kids who need community service hours, they work with us and they want to help. Every project that I've done that we've worked with in town and different things, they've provided all the supplies. And when they don't have them on hand, they buy more. They order stuff. So it's not all bad. Think about this. The public library and the public middle school have opened their doors free of charge for us to serve the community. Okay? I talked to Judge Greth this week in Fleetwood. And she is aggressively sending kids to Cornerstone to get help, to work community service hours. And she sees us as a place where kids that she is pulling her hair out and doesn't know what to do, maybe you can help. We just talked today, and she asked, is it okay, all the people that we're sending to you, are you guys okay with that? Yeah. Yeah, we're okay with that. Our nation is not bankrupt yet. There are still people in all sectors of life who really care about people, who really want to help people, and value people like us and churches like ours as places where hope can be found. So that's good. That's good. And I would rather work on an individual level right here than try to change our country. That's just overwhelming to me. And God calls some people to do that, and I praise God for them. Maybe that's you. I don't know. But I like this working with Judge Greth and working with one person here and one person there and seeing things happen and, you know, helping churches to catch that vision. And that's exciting. So we have a light. We have a light. The light has dawned. It came from this child. And now we have it. So you look at the trends, you look at where our country's culture is going, and it's scary. When you look at those little individual situations, the door is still open for us to make a difference. There's hope. There's still hope. So now we're at number four. What should we do? What should we do? What are we supposed to do with this? If this is the atmosphere we're in, this is, it's kind of like where Isaiah was. What should we do? Think about that red Ferrari. Can we stop the crash that's coming at the end of that road? Can we stop the crash? I'm kind of skeptical that we can stop it, but we can make a difference in it. God can do that. God can turn things around completely, and maybe he will. But I suspect that sooner or later there will be some sort of crash in our future. And I don't know what that is. I'm not trying to be sensational or anything like that. I don't know what it's going to be like. But when people reject God to the degree that we are rejecting God, that's not a good direction to go. It just isn't. So what do we do? Do we just buckle up and hold on and hope the airbags work? I don't think that should be our just get on for the ride and see where it goes. We're called to make a difference in this place that we're in. Romans chapter 1 explains that when people persist in rejecting God and his wisdom, God essentially lets them go. Eric preached on this a while ago. He lets them go. He leaves them to their own self-destructive ways, and the end is not pretty. So Isaiah lived in a time like that. And his job was to sound the warning. God's judgment is coming. And his job was to keep sounding it until his life was over, until captivity came. It's just 60 years of that. But it wasn't just a message of judgment. It wasn't just sitting back and watching these people jumping off the cliff. Stinks to be you. You're dead. Nothing you can do about it. Like, that's not his message. He had hope. There's something you can do. And there's hope today. There's still hope today. As long as there's life, there's hope. So God hasn't called his people to sit back and wait for judgment. We've been called to carry a message of hope like Isaiah. We've got a message of hope. The message of Christmas is a message of hope that's desperately needed. I'll give you a scripture in 2 Chronicles. I love this verse. This is written to God's people, but it reflects God's heart. This is written to God's people in Israel. But this is God's heart. If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I'll hear from heaven. I'll forgive their sin and will heal their land. This is God's heart. He doesn't want entire nations to fall off a cliff. He wants entire nations to turn to him, to come to their senses. So you and I are not Isaiah, and we're not called to be Isaiah. But if you found hope in Jesus, if you're one who knows what Christmas is really about, you're a carrier of a powerful, powerful message that our nation and our neighbors need. And is there judgment in our message? I mean, should we speak like Isaiah spoke? Not necessarily, but there is judgment. God is holy. He's offended by our sinful rebellion, our self-exaltation, our worship of material things, our lack of concern for the poor, the way we ignore his instruction. He's deeply offended by all those things. And God's going to judge those who remain in that state. But the hope is, if we would just simply turn to God in repentance, ask forgiveness through Jesus' sacrifice, he died to pay for that, and commit to follow him, that all that judgment that we deserve is placed on him. He takes it. He takes all the judgment. I don't want to give it to you. I already put it on my son. And he'll take it off of us and put it on his son. And we are released from our debt. The chains are broken. My chains are gone. And that's where healing begins. And it happens one life at a time, one story at a time. But I like the Christmas prophet because he reminds us that Christmas is not just about presents and family and good food and time off work and all the things that we look forward to. Christmas is about hope, that someone came to take our judgment so we could receive God's forgiveness. Jesus came as a baby, and he became our Savior, our Messiah. He's going to come again as a king. All those prophecies that spoke of his birth and his death and his resurrection, very specific. There are more prophecies that speak of his second coming. He's coming again. And they were fulfilled to the letter. That one will be fulfilled to the letter too. He's coming again, this time as king. So listen to the Christmas prophet. The virgin will be with child, will give birth to a son, will call him Emmanuel, God with us. So one thing I hope you will gather out of this is that Isaiah is not the only Christmas prophet. You and I are carriers of the message. We have a message. We live in a time of darkness. We won't carry it the way Isaiah did. I mean, I kind of feel like he kind of had one of those signs in a way, like just, we don't need to carry it the way he did. We live in it. That was then. This is now. That was him. We are us. God has a unique calling for you. And maybe you're called to carry that message in very public ways, in public places. But, you know, most of us are not going to become world famous like Isaiah or Billy Graham or some of those big name people on the radio. We're not necessarily called to be that. But many of us can carry that in more intimate ways, in private settings, one-on-one. As God brings somebody into your life, we carry that message. So that's okay. We don't have to have this huge pressure on us. Just recognize, I'm a carrier of an amazing message that people really need. I was reading an Acts this week, and I just saw something that I hadn't noticed before. I hadn't paid attention to it. It's in Acts chapter 17. Paul, he's traveling, and he's sharing this message all over the place and in the world that he lived in along the Mediterranean. And he goes into Athens. He goes into Athens, and he's looking around, and he sees all the idols everywhere. They're just idols everywhere. And as he saw that, he's taking it all in. It says in Acts 17, he sees all this stuff, and he was greatly distressed. He was greatly distressed. He saw the spiritual darkness, and it really bothered him. It really troubled him. Why did it bother him so much? I mean, they have a right to worship whoever they want to worship, right? That's what you hear now, right? This is your own deal. Like, you worship who you want to worship and let them worship who they want to worship. Well, Paul didn't feel that way. He was greatly distressed. Paul wasn't just some mercenary carrying some message because he had some benefit he was going to get out of it. This message, this truth had changed his life. Big time. When God showed up and said, Paul, I think he said Saul, what are you doing? You know, and his life was turned around. He knew what was true. People do have the right to worship whoever they want, but there's true and there's falsehood. And so he was deeply bothered by it. And just noticing that stood out to me. That needs to be us. We need to be deeply bothered when people are heading over the edge of a cliff. That should deeply bother us. And that will deeply bother us as the true message of Christmas soaks into us and we are changed by it. Yeah, this Messiah who came, he came for me. He came to bring forgiveness to me. And he didn't just offer it to me. So that when it really soaks in, it will change how you celebrate Christmas. It will change that. Our family tries to be really intentional about keeping Jesus a very central part of Christmas And all day yesterday was pretty much about that. We give away some kind of baked good to our neighbors every Christmas at some point. And so we spend like the night before and the next day just preparing all the stuff and then delivering it. And we did cupcakes this year. We did a birthday theme. Just a reminder, this is Jesus' birthday. And our neighbors need people who are going to shine that light. And that's just a one-time thing and, you know, a gesture of friendliness. Our neighbors need good neighbors who have the light turned on and are looking around and want to love the people around them. So when the message changes you, you kind of naturally become another carrier of the message, like Isaiah, like Paul, like hopefully my family, and you become filled with this passion, like Paul. He's greatly distressed, and we know what's important. We know what this is about. We see the darkness. We see the need. And as that happens to you, you're going to start to see that others will find hope through you. And so that's what we want to see. There's nothing more significant in life that I can think of than sharing hope, real hope with somebody else and seeing the light go on. When you see that light go on and they get it, I can't think of anything more significant and more powerful than that. So I want to end with a story. I've been reading a book. You might not like the title of this book. It's called The Insanity of God, which this man is very respectful towards God. He's not claiming God's insane, but it seems like God is insane sometimes with the way he allows his people to be treated. And so really it's a book about stories of people who've been persecuted for their faith all over the world. He started out as a relief worker in Somalia back when things were really, things are probably still really bad, when there was more attention to Somalia. He was a relief worker and helping out. He's a Christian. And then he came back and he decided, I need to learn from Christians who've been persecuted. So he just started traveling the world and hearing people's stories. So I want to share one of these stories that happened that he experienced, that he heard from a woman. Her name is Aisha. And this is a powerful story that happened in the Middle East. And this is another Thrive story. We've been talking about Thrive. This is the Thrive story for sure. For many years, a Western faith-based organization had operated a medical clinic in one of the cities of a large Islamic country. Most of the local population appreciated having ready access to quality medical care. As a rule, the people essentially ignored the staff's religious affiliation and background. The religious beliefs of the medical staff weren't much of a concern. What mattered was the medical care. However, a few radical Muslims were concerned with the religious beliefs, and the most militant and outspoken opponent of the medical ministry lived right across the street from the clinic's front entrance. He owned a shop in that same location, which was only a few doors down from a local mosque. So every Friday, this shopkeeper, whom we will call Mahmoud, would stand in front of his store and stir up the Muslim crowd streaming by on the street as they made their way to worship. Later, at the mosque, he would accuse the evil infidels at the clinic of preying on, poisoning, or overcharging good Muslims. He would curse and condemn some of the medical staff by name. He was an angry and hateful man whose anger spilled over as he spewed animosity at anyone affiliated with this medical clinic. Later, Mahmoud contracted an incurable cancer. His superstitious Muslim community considered him contagious and quit frequenting his shop. Now he's not only sick and dying, but he's also unable to feed and provide for his wives and children. The staff of the hospital learned of his sad plight, and many of them actually began to go to his shop on their way to and from work. The clinic personnel purchased goods from the shop of their most vocal antagonist. They conversed with him and asked about his family. They regularly inquired about and expressed concern for his health. They always made a point of letting him know they were praying for him. Eventually, they began to treat his suffering and even washed his body when the need arose. As these followers of Jesus loved their persecutor and enemy for so many years, Mahmoud's stony heart softened. Over time, his attitude changed to one of gratitude and friendship. In his last days, he continued to accept the compassionate and professional medical care of the evil infidels. He trusted his former enemies to help him die in peace with dignity. Before he finally passed away at the age of 57, Mahmud made the decision to become a follower of Jesus. Mahmud's youngest wife, Aisha, suddenly became a 24-year-old widow with four children. She'd watched how the clinic staff had loved and cared for her husband after he had cursed and railed against them for so many years. During Mahmud's last days, she also became a follower of Jesus. After her husband's death, Aisha became an outspoken witness to her new faith and perhaps the most effective evangelist in that area. Her Muslim family and friends couldn't silence her witness. The authorities eventually took notice. Even though her nation didn't have a history of imprisoning women, the police finally arrested her. She was lectured and threatened with every imaginable punishment. Her captors threw her not into an actual jail cell, but down into the dank, dark, unfinished cellar of the police station. In that place, there was no light at all. The unfinished cellar had a dirt floor. Spiders, bugs, and rats skittered around her in the darkness. Terrified, and at the point of giving up, she told us that she intended to scream out to God that she couldn't take any more. But when she opened her mouth in protest and despair, a melody of praise rose out of her soul instead. She sang. Surprised and strengthened by the sound of her own voice, and overwhelmed by the renewed sense of God's presence beside and even within her, she began to sing her praise and worship to Jesus even more loudly. As she sang, she noticed that office by office, the police station above her head became strangely silent. Later that night, the trap door was opened. The light spilled down into the darkness of the cellar. The chief of police himself reached down, pulled Aisha out, and told her, "I'm going to release you and let you go home." "Please, no," she protested. "You can't do that. It's after midnight. I can't be seen on the streets alone." He, of course, knew that it was against the law for a woman to be out alone at night. She wondered if maybe this was a trick to get her in more trouble. You don't understand," the chief told her. "There's no need to worry. I'm going to personally escort you to your home on one condition." Aisha immediately suspected the man's intentions, but it turns out he had nothing sinister in mind. The chief of police, one of the most powerful men in the city, looked at 24-year-old Aisha and shook his head in bewilderment. "I don't understand," he admitted. "You're not afraid of anything." He sighed and shook his head again. "My wife, my daughters, and all the women in my family are afraid of everything. But you're not afraid of anything. So now I'm going to take you safely to your home tonight. 3 days from now, I'm going to come to get you and bring you to my house. And I want you to come to my house so that you can tell everyone in my family why you are not afraid. And I want you to sing that song." It's the insanity of God. "I want you to sing that song." Everybody's singing a song. Okay, everybody's singing a song. What song are you singing? And who's hearing it? Don't let the message of Christmas that everybody else is singing just carry you along. We have a different message. We have a better song. "Joy to the world. The Lord has come. Let earth receive her King." That's the song. We don't have to try to become world renowned like Isaiah. Most of us, we sing this song to one person. We sing it to our family. We sing it to people around. It's one person at a time. So just ask God, "Is there somebody near me who needs to hear the real message of Christmas? Is there somebody who needs to hear the song out of my mouth?" And just ask him, "God, open my eyes and then open my mouth. Let the Christmas message soak in and change you and carry that message." Isaiah is not the only prophet of Christmas. So in your notes, if you tend to write things down, if you wrote the name Isaiah next to the prophet of Christmas, maybe you'd like to write your own name next to that too. I'd like to just show a short video. And then Val's going to come and share an opportunity, because we have a chance to sing this song to a family in need.